Hey folks, welcome back to Research and Review, where we get to discuss research papers with the scientists who wrote them. Today's episode, we discuss a fascinating mechanism some viruses use to replicate their proteins. They do this by hijacking host mRNA, also known as cap snatching. Our guest today achieved his PhD in virology from the University of Cambridge before working at the University of Oxford as a postdoctoral research scientist. He is currently a research fellow at the Medical Research Council's Centre for Viral Research, MRC-CVR, at the University of Glasgow, investigating influenza viruses. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Edward Hutchinson. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Edward Hutchinson.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation to come and speak to you.
Thank you for being with us today. So to start off, where did your interest in virology come from?
So I think it crept up on me. So I started off doing quite a general undergraduate science degree, and I think I thought I wanted to be a physicist, which turned out to be an error because I'm not good enough at maths to be a physicist. But I was always very interested in biological sciences as well, and was able to specialise in them as that went on. And I finished off my degree doing genetics, but I'd done bits and pieces of pathology along the way. A lot of the people who'd sort of tutored me through that degree had been virologists or involved in that. So I think those ideas were planted in my mind. And when I joined a PhD program, which had rotations at the start, one of these ones where you can work in different labs, and they were all in different areas of infection and immunity. And I just kept choosing virology labs. And I think it was only later that I realized that I had actually been making a connection there. So I ended up working in the lab of a guy called Paul Diggard, who at the time was working at the University of Cambridge. He's now a professor at the Roslin Institute at the University of Edinburgh, and his lab works on influenza viruses. And that got me into the molecular biology of influenza viruses, and it was wonderful, and I never left. That's what I'm still working on now.
Fantastic. And would you say that since your degree was quite general, it kind of helped sort of feed into virology, because virology is so interdisciplinary? The fact you started off with an interdisciplinary degree, did you feel it kind of sort of helped you choose a subject where lots of different disciplines kind of come together?
I think that is a particular way of looking at viruses, and it's one which sits very well with me. So I did come from a fairly broad training background in the sciences, and then I did my PhD in the division of virology in the pathology department in Cambridge, where you have a lot of people studying viruses from different angles, but with a common interest in viruses. And I now work at the MRC, University of Glasgow Centre for Virus Research, or the CVR, which, once again, on a larger scale, it's a grouping of people coming at viruses from all sorts of different angles, but there's a common interest in viruses. There are other people who do extremely productive work on viruses, as biochemists studying viruses, or as immunologists who happen to be interested in viruses. So it's certainly not the only way to come at the problem. But one of the characteristic features of viruses is they're extremely small things which cause extremely big problems. So they do cut across scales, and you can take a very multidisciplinary approach to understand them in an interesting and productive way.
And with your work at the MRC CVR, what has changed since COVID-19? Do you find that a lot of the work at the Institute has sort of been hijacked by just all the COVID-19? Are you still able to do the work that you were doing previously?
Yeah, so it's been, as you would expect, at the CVR, as everywhere else, it's the last year brought a huge number of changes. So the CVR is the MRC Centre for Virus Research. It would be weird if it didn't commit itself fully to tackling the pandemic, particularly in its early stages. And of course that happened. But simultaneously, we had to work safely. So we were still implementing social distancing. We had to prioritize projects. So what happened in practice was that people who were able to pivot their work very readily to working on SARS coronavirus did so. And that included, for example, colleagues who work on bioinformatics and viral genomics, who did a lot about the evolution of the virus and how it's spreading, colleagues who are clinical academics who were involved in clinical trials, people who were well set up for screens or working with viruses in high containment, who put a huge amount of work into developing a molecular biology toolkit for studying the virus and making that freely available to others. So a lot of that work was done very, very intensively and with people working under very demanding conditions, but equally people who weren't at the front line, what was incumbent of them was to clear out of the way to make that to happen. So for my own group, actually, we're now doing some SARS projects, but initially we weren't doing many SARS projects hands-on. We did quite a bit of science communication around SARS coronavirus. And then like scientists in labs working on non-critical work in any area, we were then working from home for a long time, doing what work we could to advance projects in terms of data analysis and things like that. So I think there was a real balance in terms of how people are working. And even now, where we've been able to get a lot of the other projects back up and running again, we're still in a mixed model, and people are working from home as well as working in the labs, depending on what they're trying to do. So it's been a mixed model in terms of how it works overall. But overall, it's been really impressive to see how a centre which can study the virus in so many different ways has come together to produce really interesting work, which links together all of those capacities and competencies which the CVR has. So it's been an interesting year. Also, and I think this is true for everyone, regardless of what we're doing, a rough year as well. But I think that's true across the board.
And we'll move on to your paper now, which is called, well, the paper that you co-authored, which is the hybrid gene origination creates human virus chimeric proteins during infection, which is a very interesting paper, because when you first go on it, you just see a massive, you know, list of names and co-authors. And from a previous podcast you were on, you spoke about the story behind your paper. Could you sort of briefly touch on, you know, how it came to be there was all these different co-authors, investigators on the paper?
Yeah, sure. So, I really like talking about this, because I think this is a really nice example of scientists being nice to each other. And I think sometimes science gets a bit of a reputation being quite cutthroat, which, you know, does sometimes happen. People do like collecting the bad stories, so it's nice to be able to tell one of the good ones. I think it's also a good example of some of the opportunities which are now coming out for collaborative working. So this all started for me quite a long time ago when I was working as a postdoc in the lab of a guy called Irvin Foda, who's a professor down at the University of Oxford. I was doing mass spectrometry on virus particles and identifying the proteins in there, and found a really weird fragment of a protein which we just couldn't explain from the normal understanding of how the virus made proteins, why that was there. And I kept sort of prodding this in the background of the projects I should have been working on, and then formed a hypothesis of how it might be produced, which turned out indeed to be correct once we finished the paper. And then the time came when I was going to apply to set up my own group. And very generously, Irvin, instead of saying, I'm going to continue working on this, good luck to you, said, no, take this with you, use this as part of your preliminary work to set up your own group. So I went off and I did that. That was when I moved up to the CVR. And I started working with a very talented postdoc, Liz Sloan, who was able to do a lot of molecular biology on that. But we rapidly realized that although we could figure out how this protein was made using some standard techniques, in order to properly dig into it, we were going to need to use a lot of really quite complex and resource-intensive methods. And we were a new lab and a small lab, and we couldn't do all that by ourselves. And so it was a really nice opportunity to start working with friends and colleagues, and indeed to contact new people and to build up a network of collaborators who could come up at this from different angles. So we worked with immunologists and bioinformaticians and people working on other viruses within the University of Glasgow. We worked on people who did mouse studies in Portugal, and colleagues in Edinburgh and Cambridge who looked at how RNAs were produced. Liz, towards the end of his project, had a baby, which was lovely. So molecular biology was finished off by another postdoc, Leah Mayer, who joined the group, who also did really nice work on that. So we were able to pull this story together. And then there was this really difficult day when I was just working in the university library, and I got an email from one of our collaborators saying she'd just been to a seminar by a guy called John Udell, who really well-known scientist in the States, who was presenting a story which sounded very much like the one we were working on. And they had a preprint out, and had we seen it? And I hadn't seen it. And so I looked at it, and it was basically, you know, different, slightly different methods, but basically the same ideas all the way through, same conclusions. And we hadn't quite finished our study, and they had just submitted theirs. And that wasn't a great morning, to be honest. And I think classically, this is the point where people talk about being scooped in science, where just, you know, the sky falls in and everything's terrible. But, you know, we thought, well, you know, we'll, at least we can still write it up and submit it. We will still have a story. So I went to PoS Biology, which is a journal who have introduced a policy that they won't ignore stuff just because someone else has published something similar. They'll give you 6 months or so where you can still get that study out to try and push back against this zero-sum game approach to science. So I wrote it up, and I did two things which I hadn't really thought of doing before. One was, in the discussion of our paper, I cited and discussed the preprint of the other study. And I'd never really, preprint literature had been around for a while, but it was always kind of gray matter. You didn't discuss it in formal writing. You just read it and was rude about it to your colleagues or not, depending on what. So actually discussing it in our own paper was a new experience for me. And it's obviously very useful to discuss it because it came to the same conclusions. They lent against each other. The other study was very, very nicely done. And the other thing I did, which I hadn't much experience of them, was my lab had just got me on Twitter. So I mentioned that we put our preprint out on Twitter once we did submit our paper. And I mentioned the other lab study and suggested people read that. And then two things happened. So firstly, we got reviews back from a journal we'd submitted to, and they wanted improvements made to the paper. They're broadly positive, and they actually really liked the fact that we discussed the preprint. But the other thing was that because we'd mentioned this on social media, word got back to Ivan Marazzi, the lead author on the other paper, that this had happened. And I got a call from Ivan, who basically said, look, I'm fed up with fighting with people in science. Why don't we just bring these studies together? Theirs was under review at Cell, which is one of the most sort of prestigious journals which you can publish in this field. Just bring the studies together. All the first authors will still be first authors. All the senior authors will still be senior authors. These are sort of marks of seniority and contribution to papers. So that's important for people's careers. Everyone who's contributed still gets acknowledged, and the studies will back each other up and everybody wins. So that's what we did. And it wasn't a particularly easy process, as you can imagine. There were two massive studies. We had, I think, 54 co-authors by that point to try and bring together and keep on board. Ivan and I write in extremely different styles, so we had to somehow reconcile two very different ways of telling this story. But that all went in. And PoS Biology, I have to say, as well as being great to submit to, were lovely about the fact that we were now withdrawing our paper to do this. They were completely on board with that and understood. If we have a nice enough story to go again, I definitely would. But it went into Cell, who in the end accepted it. So we ended up with a paper which Ivan and his lead postdoc on it, Jess Sutko, introduced this terminology of Frankenstein proteins to describe the chimeric proteins that we found to be produced. I think it's also very much a Frankenstein paper. Particularly if you're involved in preparing it, you really can see it has been stitched together, both from multiple projects which form the collaborations and from these two collaborations coming together. I can see the stitching. I hope it's not too obvious if you're reading it and haven't been through that process. But yeah, that was how it came together. So I like telling this story because it's an example of people working together and science being better because of that. And no one gets kicked onto the curb through the process as well. So it's nice to see that that is possible and is something we can aspire to do in science.
One word that you mentioned was chimeric that I'm not sure all of our listeners are familiar with. Could you give us a brief description of what chimeric means?
Yeah, so this is, so there was some slightly wacky terminology which we introduced into the paper, like Frankenstein proteins and upstream frameshifted open reading frames, which got abbreviated to UFOs. But the Chimerica is actually quite a well-established term in biology. I'm sure you'll be familiar with it from your own work, but for listeners who perhaps might not be. So the Chimera was a creature in Greek myth, which was multiple animals together. I think it had the head of a lion and the body of a goat, and its tail was a snake or something. You wouldn't want to get too close anyway. But then in genetics, people realized that you can have genes which are chunked together. So you start off in one gene and you get into another gene. And because proteins can be encoded in a modular fashion, this often works quite well. And so the effect you have when you join two bits of genetic sequence together becomes a chimeric gene. And similarly, proteins which are fused together are chimeric proteins. And in this case, it's a little unusual because the joining together of genetic information isn't hard encoded into the viral genome, but instead it turns up during the transcriptional process of influenza viruses. So they have this trick called cap snatching, which they use to get transcription to work. And because of that, they are forced to join together sequences from the host and sequences from the virus. And what we showed is that then actually starts producing novel proteins as well.
You said in a previous podcast that the work with chimeric proteins started at your time at Oxford. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. So I was... this basically all comes out of me not being very good at biochemistry. So my PhD, I went to work for Irvin Fodor, who is really just a fantastic RNA biochemist. He's done a lot of work on how the influenza virus polymerase, which is the beautiful molecular machine which takes an RNA genome and copies it to make more RNA, which might not sound terribly exciting, but our bodies do not do that. So the virus really needs a machine to do that. We always make RNA from a DNA template. So this is a molecular machine which is unique to viruses. And Evan's done a huge amount of work to characterize how it works. I thought, yes, I should definitely go and learn to do this. And it turns out that to study these things effectively, you need to be very good at very exacting biochemical methods to separate out small scraps of very chemically fragile nucleic acids. And I'm rubbish at doing this, it turns out. I'm just a horrible biochemist. And so after a while, you know, we produced a study, which was fine. I don't think either of us were terribly happy with it. And we were kind of wondering what to do. And I think some people might have been encouraged to say, well, maybe what we should do is you should look for exciting opportunities elsewhere. But I think a testament to Irvin being a good mentor is what he actually said was, I think you need to find a project which you're going to do well at. And instead of forcing me to go down the route we both originally intended, and which he planned for, he encouraged me to identify projects which would suit the skill set I did have better and which we could use to do new and interesting science. And just because of some of the stuff which was going on in the department, I saw some work presented by a PhD student in one of the other labs using mass spectrometry to look at proteins, and I thought that seemed very interesting. Started talking to the mass spectrometry lab, who were at the time based in the Sir William Dunn School of Pathology, where I was working. And we started cooking up projects to look at the proteins in influenza viruses. So first we found a load of sites where viral proteins were modified by phosphorylation, and that regulated them. That led to some interesting follow-on work. And then we worked out what the proteins were in virus particles and how those vary between different hosts. So there were a number of projects which came out of this. And then we started getting these weird incidental findings in the background, one of which was this peculiar protein. I'm pretty sure this was Irvin's idea. He just said, well, just look to see if you can see anything being translated from viral genes, even if you don't actually think there's a canonical protein there. So I did look, and we found this one weird peptide in a kind of clickbait way, which we couldn't explain. And that was what led to the project, because that one weird peptide was being produced as a chimeric protein, or specifically it was being produced by the virus getting a sequence from the host which had a start codon, which was stuck just upstream of the viral sequence. So I don't know how familiar your listeners will be with this, but genes always have a, almost always have an upstream untranslated region. So a sequence which the ribosome, once it's bound to the mRNA, just spools through without producing any protein before it gets to what's called the start codon, which is the go signal for reading that nucleotide sequence and using that to create a protein. What we found was that because of the way influenza and other similar viruses work, they've had to stick a little bit of host-derived sequence before the viral transcript. And if that host-derived sequence happens to contain a start codon, then the ribosome starts reading prematurely. And as a result, it can then translate sequences which wouldn't normally get translated in the virus. So initially we found the sequence, which was basically an extension of one of the viral proteins. It had started reading sequence early, and so it had given it a longer front end, what we call the N-terminus. Because of the way the genetic code works, and your listeners may or may not be familiar with this already, but it's a triplet code, so you're reading sets of three letters at a time as you go through the genome. You can also have what are called frame shifts. So if you move forwards or start site either one position or two positions, but not three positions, then everything you have gets shifted out of register. So instead of reading A, B, C, D, E, F, G, E, H, you have a new set of instructions which go B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J. So you can get a different set of instructions out of the same sequence. And what we eventually found was that the virus was also doing this. It had these gene products which were written on top of the canonical gene products, but were frame shifted on top of them as well. And these could be accessed through this mechanism as well. So the biochemistry does get a little bit involved there, but it's basically one of a number of ways in which these viruses, which have teeny tiny genomes, can pack a huge amount of coding information into them. So I don't know if you've ever been to the Wellcome Collection in London, the museum run by the Wellcome Trust down on the Euston Road, but they have
But I'm aware that they have like printouts of like the viral genome, and it's like very small.
Yeah, so they've got the human genome there. It's a bookcase. So they've printed out all 3 billion odd characters of human genome. And yeah, it's this big bookcase of fairly densely printed books. And yeah, if you print out the flu genome on that scale, it's a sheet of paper. And it's got to get all the information it needs into there. So like most viruses, flu has all sorts of tricks to maximize the amount of information it can pack into its genes, and this seems to be another one. How useful that information is, of course, is now something we're working to find out. It does seem we have some evidence in the problem which we presented in the paper that if you muck around with these novel gene products which we hadn't previously looked at, the virus doesn't like it very much. So we think they are doing something, but exactly what that is, we still don't know. And it is possible that this is just noise in the system, but it's something which is basically firing out gene products in all directions, and some of them are just there because they're there. But it does seem that if you they're there all the time, and if you muck them up, then the virus suffers as a result. So we think they are doing something important.
Fantastic. So from the information you got at Oxford, and when you started coming, you set up your group and you were like, this is the subject I'm going to look at, what were the things that you wanted to prove in your paper, and what were the things you wanted to, you know, cut away and say, no, that's not possible? Were you looking for like any particular things when you were doing your research on these mRNA cap?
We are aware that there are upstream regions before the start sites of most genes. We know that for viral genes, those upstream regions are typically shorter. We know that for a group of viruses called the negative strand RNA viruses, which include influenza, they use a process called cap snatching. So maybe a bit of virology would help here. I think you'll be aware of this, but once again, maybe not all of your listeners will be. So viruses are molecular parasites. They don't just steal nutrition from their hosts. They actually steal the use of the molecular machinery of the host cell. And in particular, they make use of ribosomes, the protein-producing machines of the cell. So they need to be able to provide the ribosomes with something which we recognize as a message, a messenger RNA. Different viruses do this in different ways. The way the negative strand RNA viruses do it is that they grab hold of mRNAs which have been produced by the host cell, and they chop off the starting sequence, what we call the 5' cap, and a short sequence of code beyond that. And then they use that as a primer. They extend it to copy their own genes. So they chop off this cap snatch leader sequence, and then they start adding new sequence to the end of that, which is a copy of their own genes. So you'll have cap snatch leader sequence from the host, and that can be extremely variable in sequence. It's usually about 12 nucleotides long, 11, 12, but extremely variable in sequence. And then you have the untranslated region encoded by the viral genome. And then finally you have a viral gene. That has two effects. One is that it really shuts down the host's ability to produce its own genes, so it really drives the virus taking over the cell, something we call host shutoff. But also it means that when that mRNA is then given to a ribosome, it recognizes it as looking like an mRNA. It's got the right starting end, so it can read into it. So we know all this. We also know that although start codons tend to be some way from the beginning position of an mRNA, a start codon is the go signal, if you like, for the ribosome. So you spool through until you get to a start codon, then you start looking to see what protein is encoded in the genes. In a small proportion of mRNAs, our start codon is very close to the beginning. So we thought, could those be chopped off in the cap snatching process and stuck upstream of a viral gene? And if that happened, one of two things could happen. Either you could extend the viral gene because you start reading earlier, or you could, in the way I described before, have frame-shifted genes which overlap the canonical viral gene. So the first thing we wanted to ask was, do suitable start codons exist in the cap snatch sequences? So we, using two different techniques, two labs came together, carried out deep sequencing of the cap snatch leader sequences, and we found that yes, absolutely, somewhere between 5% and 10% of them do contain plausible start codons, or at least they contain AUG codons, which can act in that way. But just because they can doesn't mean they do. So we next looked to see whether ribosomes were sat on them. And to do that, we used a technique called ribosomal footprinting, where you take your cell with ribosomes reading along the mRNAs. You add a chemical linker to attach the ribosomes to the RNA sequence. You digest away all the RNA that the enzymes which digest the RNA can't get to the bit the ribosome is sat on. And then you take the bit which is protected by the ribosome and sequence that. And the trick we used there was we used a drug called Harantanine, which if a ribosome is initiating, so if it's at the start codon and getting ready to begin producing protein, it will stay sat there. But if it's already elongating, so if it's already reading a protein, Harantanine won't touch it and it'll just keep on going. If you pre-treat the cells with Harantanine, what you get is ribosomes parked on your start codons and the others have all cleared off. So if you do your ribosomal footprinting that way, you can work out, are there ribosomes sat on these sequences? And yes, there are. And actually they're sat at a frequency which is kind of consistent with the start codons and those capped actually the sequences we found. So, okay, that suggests that something could happen. And then we look at the viral genes and we say, could that encode genes? Because it's all right if a ribosome start producing the protein, but if it hits a stop codon, it will stop producing protein. And actually, most of the time, that is what happens. The ribosome hits the stop codon pretty much immediately. And then you don't get anything which could be of plausible interest. But in a number of cases, in fact, in about half of the theory. So what we did in the paper was we used a trick to see whether the immune system could see these proteins. We knew they shouldn't really be visible to antibodies because they weren't going to be presented on the surface of virus particles. But most cells will constantly chew up a portion of the proteins inside them and load those chewed up fragments or peptides onto a holder called major histocompatibility complex, an MHC molecule, and that will be put onto the cell surface. And those fragments of all of the proteins in the cell will be displayed to the immune system, and T cells will then come and monitor this and see whether there's anything suspect inside the cell. And if there's a sequence which they recognize as being from a pathogen, they will kill the infected cell. So we could carry out an experiment to test whether or not these proteins were subject to surveillance by T cells. And the way we did that was we took a very, very well characterized sequence called epitope, so something recognized by an immune cell. We took a very well characterized sequence from egg white albumin, so of albumin, which has no relation to flu at all. It's just a really well characterized immunological tool. And we used genetic engineering to insert that sequence into the viruses so that a protein containing that sequence would only be produced if this novel, what we call start snatching mechanism, is taking place. So if it would only be produced by one of these chimeric proteins. But if that was produced, you'd then have of albumin tagged proteins in the cell, and they should be picked up by T cells. And we then use T cells from mice who have themselves been genetically engineered to be super, super attentive to the presence of this particular epitope. And once again, both us and Ivan Marazzi's lab, the other lab who've been pursuing this, hit on exactly the same idea. So we did this experiment twice with the tags put in different proteins and with slightly different experimental designs. But we both got the same result. Yes, if you stick this this over two peptide, it's called, into a protein which could only be produced if start snatching was happening, and then you put these T cells on which are looking for that peptide, they go mad. They can see it really clearly. This shows that it is a target for the immune system. It's a bit of a binary experiment. If I was going to criticize this experiment, I would say that one of the nice things about doing it this way is that it's exquisitely sensitive. You can have tiny, tiny quantities of this peptide and it will still get picked up. But in a sense, that's also a bad thing because you can pick up stuff which is just barely there at all. So there's some unpublished work we've done since where we've repeated the experiment inside mice. This has been done with our collaborator Megan McLeod, and we can look at the endogenous levels of expression rather than doing it with cells in the dish, and we can see that we are getting responses once again to this very well characterized epitope, but they're similar to the levels of responses we get to one of the major viral antigens. So we think there is a good response there, and we're now getting experiments underway which aim to look to see whether or not responses, I suppose, could be protective against the virus, because if so, that means there are targets for the immune response which we've never looked at before. We don't yet know what the answer to that is. That's stuff we're still working on, but that's obviously something we're very keen to find out.
Absolutely, very interesting. And finally, just to ask, is your future research going to be related to some of the stuff that you didn't find out in this paper? Or are you moving on to sort of something a bit different in your work as a principal investigator?
So I hope so. I mean, it's not the only project we're looking at in our group. So you know, there are other projects going on. As I mentioned, we are continuing to look at some aspects of this, particularly to try and find out, I guess, to continue chasing that question, does it matter both for infection and for immunity? So at the moment, Leah Mayer, the postdoc I mentioned before, is continuing to work on that. We have a grant under review at the moment, which you never really know with grants. I really hope it gets funded. And if it does, that will allow us to continue working on it. So I hope we will be able to continue working on it. But we also, as you would imagine, have a range of other projects in the lab as well to do with other forms of variation in influenza virus particles as well. So it's been an interesting story to pick up and run with, but one of a number of things we'll hopefully look at and pay a lot.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for your time today, and best of luck on that research grant.
Thank you very much. I think I'm going to, yes. You always feel that way with grants. So thank you very much. And thank you for inviting me to talk to you today. It's been great to talk to you about this.
No problem at all. Perfect. And that's the time.